as I was going through the journey of trying to have kids, I was like, I am not feeling like there are any resources for me. I don't feel connected to what the genetic counselors are giving me. I don't feel connected to what the doctors are giving me for literature. It's like these little paragraphs of people's moments, but they're completely out of context. They're not my story. Yeah, I just didn't really relate, and I didn't feel, I found it really difficult to find resources that matter to me. I was like, I feel like I need to add to this conversation. I need to really bring this situation into the broader context of life, of like, how did I get to this point of being a single mom by choice? How did I get to this point of just plugging on through IUI and IVF and double donor embryo transfers? And like, how did it all happen?
Hi folks, before we get into today's episode, this is your friendly reminder that this podcast is for education, information, and entertainment only, and is not a substitute for professional mental health care. If you or someone you love is struggling with their mental health, please reach out to a mental health professional for individualized and personalized care. Hello, hello, and welcome all you beautiful and lovely people out there listening. You have found your way to the Beyond Postpartum podcast. If this is your first time here, a big hello and welcome. Beyond Postpartum is a podcast where we get to talk about all things related to perinatal and parental mental health. And my name is Heather, and I am not only the host of this podcast, but I am also one of the peer support staff and group facilitators at the Pacific Postpartum Support Society. Pacific Postpartum is located in Burnaby, British Columbia, which is the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Stalo First Nations. At Pacific Postpartum, we offer mental health and emotional support to new parents and families here in the Lower Mainland, all over British Columbia, Canada, and even internationally. I'm really excited to introduce you to my guest for this week's episode of Beyond Postpartum. So this week, I had the lovely Miriam Steinberg come and sit down with me to have a little chat. She shares her journey to becoming a single parent by choice with us, but also in her soon-to-be-released graphic novel called Catalog Baby, a memoir of infertility. So she not only shares her story in her book, which is pretty amazing, I have to say, but she also sat down with me and shared her story of her fertility journey and her journey through her complicated pregnancy with her now 2-year-old twins. And I'm really excited to share it with you today. I think I've said excited like 18 times, so you know it's going to be a good one. Just a little heads up, though. Topics about miscarriage and pregnancy loss come up in our conversation. And also part of Miriam's journey includes her making the decision to terminate a pregnancy when the baby was found to have some genetic abnormalities or anomalies. So if these are hard topics for you to hear about, please take care of yourself and reach out support if you need it while you're listening. It's also okay not to listen or to pause and take breaks or to come back to this episode at a later time. Do whatever you need to do to be well. And with that in mind, let's jump into the interview. And as always, I'll catch you on the flip side with a few closing thoughts.
So my name is Miriam Steinberg, and I wrote a book called Catalog Baby, which is a memoir about my fertility journey. I had a really intense journey towards having kids. I now have a set of twins, boy-girl twins. And it took me about 4.5 years to get to that point. I also want to make like really clear that everybody's journey is so different. There's so many similarities to a lot of them, but fundamentally, everything is different. And so my story is my story, somebody else's is their story. And I really, it's really important for me to feel like just because I ended up with a happy ending doesn't mean that I don't understand that. I cringe when I think of being like that person that says, and you too, if you try hard enough, can have your kids, because it's not always true. And I think if I hadn't been successful with this final pregnancy, I don't think I would have gone on. I was really at the end of my rope. But just to kind of go through it, so I ended up having to go through it as a single mom by choice. I was dating somebody and they weren't ready for kids when we broke up. Essentially for that reason, I decided that I didn't have time to try and find somebody. Us fall mutually madly in love with each other and try to figure out, do we want kids? And yeah, that process would have been just way too, I would have been 125. I was already 40 at the time. So I decided I'd wait till my birthday, which was probably about 8 months down the line, to see if I met anybody. And if I did not meet anybody, then it was all green light. I was going to just go ahead and do it on my own. But even if I had set that deadline to meet somebody, I actually made an appointment with a fertility clinic just in case there was a wait list, and turned out there was. So it was about a 6-month wait list. So I'm glad I did it at that time. And come my birthday, nobody had come around. So I went ahead and had to choose a sperm donor. And that was a really quite challenging. I had a few criteria that were deal breakers, like health. I made Excel spreadsheets. So it's like health, looks, intelligence. Those were kind of my three main criteria. Oh, and also, did they have successful reported pregnancies? And so I had to go through hundreds and hundreds of profiles and see who was a match for me and who I liked. And I finally found a couple people actually. And I did my first IUI, which is the turkey basting at the clinic. And I got pregnant right away. And I was super excited. I was like, yeah, my body's working. It's going to be great. All my fantasies are going to be coming to life. And then the day before my first ultrasound at 8 weeks, I miscarried. And basically my world just shattered around me. And I started getting an inkling of how pregnancy is not a given. And birth of a live, healthy child is not a given. But I kind of picked myself up by the bootstraps. And as soon as I could, I started again and again and again and again. And I just couldn't get pregnant anymore. And I did one DIY try as well because the clinic was closed. I'd found a friend who was willing to donate. And when the clinic was closed, I called him up and I was like, so remember that discussion we'd had several months ago? Are you still interested? And he's like, yeah, totally. No problem. And we tried and it was not successful. So I went back to the clinic and eventually I did get pregnant again. Then I found out that there were genetic anomalies with the baby. And I had to decide, was I going to keep the baby? Was I going to terminate? What was I going to do? And that was really crazy hard because it's basically 50-50 as to whether they would either survive or have, if they would survive, would they be healthy? Would they have just so many issues, disabilities and whatnot, that as a single parent, it would just be completely overwhelming and completely something that I wasn't necessarily ready to take on. And it's interesting because if I hadn't known, obviously I would have done everything possible to advocate for my kid, but for better or for worse, I did have the luxury to find out. And I did the testing because of my age. And because of the journey that I chose to go on. And yeah, anyways, long story short, I chose to terminate. which was really, really brutal. If I thought the miscarriage was brutal, this was infinitely worse. And after that, I was like, I have to switch to IVF, because with IVF, you can get genetic testing of the actual embryo. And I couldn't go through that whole process again. I couldn't deal with having to make another decision like that, just in case I did get pregnant again, and just in case another baby had genetic issues as well. So I did 3 rounds of IVF altogether. The first 2 rounds, I got a bunch of eggs, got a decent number of embryos, and every single one of them was not viable. So then you start really like questioning yourself as a woman, as a mother, as like just what has fate dealt me? You know, not only am I not able to carry a child so far, or the fetus has issues, but like all my eggs are rotten. Like what? It's terrible. It's horrible. And then the third one, I got one embryo that was viable. I was so excited, and I promptly miscarried that one. And by then I was so exhausted, and I just didn't have much hope left. I ended up having to kind of like delegate the hope to my friends and family so that I could have the space to just keep going. One of the most important things that my counselor had suggested for me to do to help me kind of make decisions and keep going was, imagine yourself for a week with the decision that that's it, you're done. You've done 10 tries. What does it feel like to live a life with that decision? Like 100% you're not having a kid. And then live another week as if, no, you've made the decision to continue. What does that mean? How do you feel? And live 100% like you are having a kid. So I started with I'm not having a kid week. And I think I lasted like 5 or 6 hours.
It was obviously not the right decision.
Not the right decision. So then I had to kind of be like, okay, so this is how I'm feeling, but that means that I just have to go through the steps. It's just all about logistics, and I have to just shove all the emotions and shove all the hope and shove everything into the closet so that I could just get through it day by day. So I could try at least and meet my goal. And by then I'd hit another wall where it's like, I wasn't ready to, like the statistics just weren't in my favor. And I decided to go for an egg donor as well as a sperm donor. And it was a really big process kind of switching over to that. Kind of actually getting a little bit emotional about it right now. Just thinking about it, because it's like, when you think about having a baby, most people are like, I want it to be my own genetics. I want to pass my family line down. There's the feeling of wanting to be pregnant and wanting to have a kid, but it's also, you know, passing your lineage on and also your self-worth as a woman and as a mother, and all that gets called into question. And like, am I going to bond with this baby that is technically genetically not similar to me? And then I learned about epigenetics, which is super duper cool. And for folks who don't know, epigenetics is when your DNA sequence, it doesn't change. So just because I have donor egg, donor sperm, they're going to have their genetic sequence, and it doesn't change because of mine. But the environment in which it grows kind of informs which little tabs wake up and which ones sleep.
Right.
So there's certain traits that might look like you or might act like you. And it's not because their DNA has changed. It's simply because various things went dormant or woke up or whatever. And it's all because they gestated inside of you, or, you know, they're influenced by the environment.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. It's super cool. So that really helped me kind of come to terms with all of that. So I chose my first egg donor, another egg from the egg bank. And that was even harder, because I was like, I sort of want them to look like me.
Mm.
At least have brown hair, kind of look a bit Jewy. It took me a while to find somebody, and I had to keep looking through the catalog over and over again every time they added new people to it. But I actually found somebody, and I got one batch. And weirdly, I only got one healthy embryo out of it, which is quite unusual because they're significantly younger than me. So theoretically, their eggs should be good. So I transferred that embryo, which I then miscarried. And then I had to choose another egg donor because the first one, she didn't have any eggs left at the bank. So I chose another egg donor, and I got 5 healthy embryos out of it, which is super exciting. And when I went in for my tests, the doctor's like, your lining's great, your hormone's great. She's telling me this on the phone as I'm walking down Commercial Drive, busy street. She's like, yeah, and so tomorrow when we do the transfer, we're going to transfer 2 in. And I'm like, say what now? Okay, let me just pull over into this quiet street so I can process this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she's like, well, you know, because of your history of loss and all that stuff, putting 2 in gives you a better chance of having at least 1 stick and stay. So I was like, all right, well, I guess better 2 than none. And so, yeah, the next day they transferred 2 in. And then the day after that, I was at home in my kitchen and sitting on a chair, and all of a sudden it's like my belly started twinkling. Mm. And I'm like, holy shit, they both stuck. It was such a crazy feeling. And I kept having all these really weird moments, not just with this pregnancy, but previous pregnancies as well, of like names showing up so I would know the gender of the baby without ever being told what it was. Mm-hmm. But their names would just float past. So none of the names that I have given to my kids, the ones that I miscarried, the Zaria, like Layla, Dahlia, they just showed up. And then the same thing with my current kids, Isaac and Abigail. I was lying in bed and their names just floated past. And I was like, I guess I'm having a boy and a girl.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. And then it got confirmed by the genetic counselor like weeks later. She's like, she called me. She's like, so I have the sex of the babies if you want to find out. And I'm like, oh, I sort of do and I sort of don't. She's like, I just want to know. And I'm like, I just want to know if I'm right. And so she said, okay, why don't you tell me what you think it is and I'll tell you if you're right. So I was like, okay, I think it's a boy and a girl. She's like, oh my God, how did you know? So I told her the story about the names, and yeah. And it's interesting because they're not names that I would have ever picked if I had to sit there and go through a list of names, because I wanted names of people that I didn't know. And I know a bunch of Abigails and I know a bunch of Isaacs. So I wanted kind of more unusual names or rarer names anyways. But then I looked up the definitions. And Isaac means laughter, and Abigail means father's joy. And even though there wasn't a father in the picture, it was all about joy. Like, both names are about joy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, you can't have joy if you're not alive. And to me, it was like, these kids are going to be alive.
Mm.
They are going to happen. So that was pretty special.
Yeah. And I'm really curious if your history of previous losses influenced or impacted how you felt about your pregnancy with them. Like, was there anxiety attached to it? Were you like kind of holding on for dear life the whole time? Or how did it feel to be finally pregnant after all that time?
Oh, geez. It was such a mixed bag. On the one hand, there was a lot of anxiety. I had a subchorionic hemorrhage during the first trimester. So I was bleeding a lot. So there was a lot of anxiety around that. And my midwives and my OB were brilliant. They were so amazing. Oh, sorry, I didn't have an OB yet. The fertility clinic, they were amazing. And they let me have as many Dopplers and as many ultrasounds as I wanted. And the fertility clinic was like, we will follow you until you're 12 weeks along. We don't normally, if everything seems to be going well, but because of your anxiety and because of the bleeding and because of your history, we're happy to give you a weekly ultrasound, even if you want. So yeah, they were really awesome about that. And I went with Strathcona Midwifery with Cora and Stephanie, and they were also like super amazing and supportive, and yeah, so really helped kind of relieve that. And I also felt like I really damped down the joy and the excitement about being pregnant. And there was a lot of like day by day, just, I'm just going to make it through this day, and I'm going to make it through this day, and I'm excited, but I'm also like, there is no safe point. 12 weeks is this mythical safe zone. And I don't believe it in it anymore. And I know too many people who lost babies at 6 months and or who had stillborn babies. And like, I'm not going to really believe it until they are in my arms and they're breathing. And yeah. So yeah, there was a lot of that.
Do you mind sharing more about your pregnancy and the birth and, sure, and all of that? Cause I know that they were both quite early as well. So
they were, yeah. So, oh boy, at 18 weeks, my water broke. Yeah, for twin A. So twin A was Isaac. And at first, you know, it was like a little bit like the movies where I just finished a shower. I went into my bedroom to get dressed and sploosh, there's water everywhere. And I'm like, what is that? I don't know what it is. Is it pee? Is it like some random, I don't know what that, because I'd never made it that far into pregnancy that might happen. And then I kind of sat there and I realized, no, I think the water broke. And then when I went for the ultrasound for all, you know, where they check all the body parts and make sure that the babies are all built the way they should be. I had a terrible technician. She was awful. But after she came back from showing the ultrasound to the doctor, she comes back. She's like, you need to go to the hospital. I was like, say what now? Boy. And I'm like, can I at least get an image? Because she had refused to show me the screen. She wouldn't give me any of, you know how you can print out ultrasounds. She wouldn't give me any ultrasounds. And I had to be like, can I have an image, please, of my babies? So she finally went and got a photocopy of it. And, you know, I didn't know then, but now I look at it and yeah, it's like, poor Isaac is all squished in his sack and Abigail's floating around happily in all her liquid. And so yeah, it was multiple trips to the hospital and they always were like, no, you know, there's a ferning test that they do because amniotic fluid, when it's put under a microscope, looks like a fern.
Right. Yeah.
And they're like, it's the liquid's not ferning. You're fine. Everything looks fine. You don't have quite as much water in this sack. You know, yeah, something is off, but like, we don't think that your PPROM, which is premature rupture of membrane, just take it really easy. And I just didn't believe them. And I just kept leaking and kept leaking and kept leaking. And finally I was like, no, this is an issue. And by then I had an OB and she was amazing. And I think the final time I went to the hospital, they're like, okay, yeah, your water is very likely broken. And so they sent me to the perinatologists and all the so-called experts, and everybody except for my own OB was like, you need to terminate. You need to terminate twin A to give twin B the best chance possible. And don't you think you should give your daughter the best chance? And they would give me the horrible, like they would just give me the stink eye and guilt me and like really pressure me to terminate. And reducing a twin pregnancy means you're stopping the heart of one of the babies and they stay inside you. And I'm just like, Can you tell me how there would be less grief with me carrying a dead baby inside of me for 5 months than there would be if he was either stillborn or died shortly after birth? Like, I don't understand your logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give him the best chance possible. And I've had to make a similar decision to this before, and I'm not doing that again. And I just knew, also, like, just viscerally, I knew, I 100% knew he was going to make it. And I don't know why I knew, I just knew. And they were just like, no, you really should consider terminating, blah, blah, blah. And my own OB was like, okay, here's the list of options. And termination was one of them. And as soon as I said, no, I'm not terminating, she's like, okay, fine. Here we go. We're doing this. This is what you need to do. And this is what's going to happen, which I am so eternally grateful for.
Yeah. I just like, I'm hearing like that strength of your intuition, like all with all of those, like the instances of knowing your baby's names and knowing the sex of your babies. And then just also knowing that Isaac and Abigail were going to stick around and be with you.
Yeah.
Quite beautiful.
Totally.
Yeah.
So anyways, I ended up on bed rest for a long time. I was at home on the couch for 7 weeks. And there were a few trips to the emergency within that. And at one of them, my OB managed a few weeks before I was even allowed to, she managed to get me on the home care team. So that meant that I could be on bed rest at home. And then I would have nurses come every single day to check the heartbeats of the babies, make sure that there wasn't an infection. And it was amazing. They would do NST tests. They would, so it was like every few days they would do an NST, and then the rest of the time they would just use a Doppler to check for the heartbeats. So that was amazing until one day I bled too much, and the nurse who came, she's like, you are going to the hospital right now. And you are not leaving the hospital until you give birth. So then I proceeded to spend 8 weeks at the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
On bed rest there, like growing your babies still inside you.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was crazy town. Yeah. And it's like even walking 50 meters, like just everything slows down, and I would just lose so much amniotic fluid. I would go through pad after pad after pad. And so I spent my days drinking water, drinking coconut water and apple juice, and like anything that's like super hydrating, I would just down it all day long, because I found out the more you drink, the more the baby drinks, the more the baby pees, the more amniotic fluid there is, because amniotic fluid is pee. Yeah. So, and the important thing in lung development is all about, for the lungs to be healthy and develop properly, they need to be flooded with amniotic fluid. That's what expands and contracts the lungs in utero. And so if there's no fluid, then the lungs don't have elasticity. They don't get that proper growth. And the other thing that the doctors were saying was like, your kid will have a high chance of cerebral palsy. That was one of the big risks of PPROM. Okay, so I was like carrying that as well. It was like this giant fear of like, is he going to come out alive? Is he going to come out healthy? Is he going to be severely debilitated? Like, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But at 32 weeks and 4 days, I went into labor. He was like, get me out of here. Yeah. I think I was like, no, I'm staying in. He's like, no, get me out of here. So I had to go in for an emergency C-section. And so they got him out. She, like I said, she didn't want to go. She was kept rolling away from the doctors.
She's like, I'm not finished cooking in here. I like it.
Exactly, right? And it's interesting because it's like, it's kind of come out in her personality now as a two-year-old. Well, throughout her whole life, actually, where she's just like, she has this thing of like, I don't know. I feel like that thing has affected her. Like, the being taken out of the womb has affected her. Oh, she's not an anxious kid, but she has like, she just has this thing about her where when she loses something or when she doesn't get what she wants, or that's just like a bit more intense than other kids. And so then Abigail was in the NICU for a month. She just needed to feed and grow. She was fine. Like she was on a breathing thing for, I think, 9 hours just to make sure that she was stable. And I was able to hold her the day after birth. Isaac, however, was on all the things. His lungs were really undeveloped. He had, they call it chronic lung disease, which is a super generic term for your lungs are messed up. They're not developed enough. There aren't enough of alveoli. They're too small. So he had chest tubes. He was on an oscillator. He was intubated. He was intubated for 10 days. And so I didn't actually get to hold him for over a week. And then one day I was in the NICU and I hear a kitten. I'm like, why is there a cat in here? There's like, we're not even allowed to have plants. Like, how is an animal in here? And then I realized that it was him and that they had taken the intubation out. And that was the first time I heard him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was crazy because you can't make a sound when you have stuff rammed down your throat, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I finally got to hold him and it was, oh my God, so intense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. How long was Isaac in the NICU for?
He was in there for 2 months.
2 months. Okay. So you probably were discharged from the hospital, I imagine. And then were you like having to go back and forth? And then when Abigail was home and he was there, like, what was that all like?
Yeah. So I got discharged after 3 or 4 days, but it's crazy because they keep you in the women's hospital section. So that means that I had to be wheelchaired from there to the NICU, which means waiting for the porter, which means you're not with your kids for the whole night. And I had to go back and forth because there, I had to take medication. And then when I was finally discharged, I lived at the NICU for the first month. I slept there. I ate there. I went home once or twice, I think after about, I can't remember, a couple of weeks, I lost it completely. I woke up. I was in severe pain because it turned out my C-section got badly infected. It took me 20 minutes to get out of bed, like just to roll over and sit. It was so painful, but I didn't know it at the time. And by then I'd already spent like 4 months essentially immobilized, two of which were at the hospital. And now I was stuck in the hospital for, I don't even know how long, because my kids were in the hospital and in incubators and I couldn't leave them. And I just lost it. I woke up and I started crying and I couldn't stop crying and I couldn't even look at them. I knew that there was a nurse in charge and that they would be fine. And I just like, I called a taxi and I got the hell out of the hospital. And it was the first time I'd been home in I don't know how long. And the whole car ride, I was bawling and the poor taxi driver, he must have thought that it was like this crazy woman. And I got home and I had a house sitter because I have a rabbit, or I had a rabbit, and I had a house sitter and I didn't even tell her that I was coming home.
Oh.
I thought she was at work because she had told me that she works from 8:30 in the morning until whatever, 4 or 5. And I figured that it was early, or it was like 9 by the time I got home. And she'd be already at work and I was only going to be home for 4 or 5 hours anyway. So it was like, she wouldn't even know that I was there. But she was home. Like, opened the door, and I'm like, this is terrible, this is horrible. I can't, I'm just, like, falling apart, and, like, all the things, and the hormones are crashing, and, like, all the grief, and the fear, and the anxiety, and everything. It's one thing to have, like, a difficult pregnancy, but to see your children in pain, or, like, covered in tubes and machines, and, like, you can't even see the baby for the things. It's just like, it's a whole other thing. It's a whole other, oh my God. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I walk in the door, and I'm just like bawling, and she's there. She's like, oh, what's going on here? I'm like, I'm sorry. I just needed a break. I need to go home. This is horrible. And she was, obviously she was fine about me being in my own home. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, a few hours later, I think I took a nap and started feeling a little bit better, and then went back to the hospital and continued doing my thing, and, you know, touching Isaac's knee and holding Abigail as best I could, because she was still attached to wires. So you can't walk around with your baby. You have to hold the baby either right by the incubator or in a chair right beside it, because it's like the heart monitor, it's her oxygen levels, and the nurses do not like it when the baby gets disconnected.
I'm sure there's all sorts of alarms that go off.
Yeah. A lot of alarms. Yeah, so that was basically my life. And then once Abigail got discharged, I think I lasted another few days of living 24/7 at the hospital, and I was like, I need to go home. I need a break. I need to self-care. And then I was like, you know, maybe it'll be good kind of training, or like I'd be able to get in some kind of rhythm and routine taking care of one baby at home. And then once Isaac is discharged, then I'll be able to incorporate him into the routine that I've already established. And it turned out that that really was the case. And yeah, so I would bring Abigail home, and then I'd bring her back to the hospital, and we'd spend the day there. So basically it was like, get to the hospital at like 1-ish in the afternoon and stay there till midnight, and then go home, try to sleep and take a little bit of care for myself, and kind of learn what it is like to have a baby at home, and you can't just leave them. And there were a few times where I was like, oh, I need to get groceries. And I'm like, right, okay. It's winter. Well, I mean, at any season, but it was winter at the time. I'm like, I can't just not take her into the store. Mm. I can't, you know, like there's all these realizations that all of a sudden you have more than your purse that you need to take into, mm-hmm. into wherever you go. And so it was an interesting learning curve, and an interesting like settling into motherhood of living children, and what that means, and how there's an attachment that's built that's not just emotional, but it's logistical and it's physical, and it's like just every aspect of humanity that you can think of gets built up kind of like Lego blocks, right?
Mm-hmm. And you have to learn it all as you go. Like you have to learn it in a moment.
Totally. Yeah. And people can tell you what their experience is, or you can read a million billion books, and really maybe it'll help a little bit, but fundamentally, because every kid is different, because every mother is different, and because every parental situation is different, everything is unique. And your reaction to your child's cries or their laughter or whatever is unique. So it's useful to have hints from other people, but really you're learning everything from scratch.
Yeah. It's that, like, I think it's from self-compassion, like that, the work around self-compassion, where, you know, everyone's situation is unique, but there's these common threads of like humanity through all of them. But like the details of all our stories are so different. But, you know, I think like even reading through your book, I had not had the same experience, but I could feel like it was a very emotional read for me. So maybe we should switch gears now and talk about your book, because I'm so curious. Like, you have this very incredible story of the journey that you went through to become a parent. why did you decide to share it in such a personal way? I mean, I love that you did, because I'm all about, I love the stories. I love hearing everyone's stories, but I'm curious what sparked that.
Well, when I started the journey, I was really sad I didn't have anybody to share it with. So I got friends to photograph and videotape everything. And Lanny, who's in the book, ended up being kind of like the main person to do all of that. I had some other friends as well who stepped in when Lanny couldn't. But at first I was like, okay, this is going to be for posterity. This is going to be the nostalgia thing. This is going to be my link to this intimacy that I'm lacking because I don't have a partner, with no thought of where it was going to go. And then after a few years, probably like 2.5, 3 years in, I was like, this is such an insane roller coaster. And it's not just because there's devastating things that are continually happening to me, but there's also some really hilarious moments and some really like, what the fuck just happened to me just now? Or, you know, like, what is going on? I'm like, this is like almost a comedy thing. And so I felt like maybe I needed to write a one-woman show about it and kind of share that everything isn't just black and white. It's not just grief and it's not just joy. It's this big mixed bag of everything. But I'm like, ugh, I'm not a theater person. I don't know how to write a play, and which is hilarious because I did not know how to write a graphic novel. And then when I eventually landed on a graphic novel because I'm a very visual person. And I felt like there were so many emotions and so many instances that just could not be described with words. And images could do that job. And as I was going through the journey of trying to have kids, I was like, I am not feeling like there are any resources for me. I don't feel connected to what the genetic counselors are giving me. I don't feel connected to what the doctors are giving me for literature. It's like these little paragraphs of people's moments, but they're completely out of context. They're not my story. They're not, I just didn't really relate, and I found it really difficult to find resources that matter to me. And so I was like, I feel like I need to add to this conversation. I need to kind of really bring this situation into the broader context of life. Of like, how did I get to this point of being a single mom by choice? How did I get to this point of just plugging on through IUI and IVF and double donor embryo transfers? And like, how did it all happen? And yeah, so that's long and the short of it.
And your book, it's not coming out till later in the month. Is that right?
So there's a launch event on the 24th of February. And then The official It's Out in Stores date is March 2nd.
Okay.
But it is available for pre-orders currently.
What has the response been so far to the book? What have you heard so far from those who've read it?
Oh my God, I am blown away. I knew it would have a bit of an impact. I did not expect how touched people are. And the words that just keep coming up over and over and over again are that it's raw and honest, and that people are blown away by it. And it feels weird. I feel like I'm like tooting my own horn here, but it's like, it's just like, I feel like people are really, really telling me that they're connecting with the story, and that there's a word I want to use. What is it? It's a synonym to honest, but it's not honest. It's like a, anyways, it'll come to me at some point. But yeah, it's people are really, really connecting to it a lot.
Well, I think one thing that struck me is that there's like a shroud of silence around so many of these topics, like infertility, miscarriage, choosing to terminate a pregnancy. Like all of those things are usually kept pretty hush hush. And so culturally and societally, it's so important to start talking about these stories. So it's that what really struck me is just how like brave it is to put it out there in a way, and also how important it is to put it out there. And so when I was reading your story, even though I couldn't, like, it's not, it didn't bring up my personal experience for me, but as a person and as a human and as a mother and a woman, being able to read it and just really understand in a more visceral way what that experience must be like, which is so powerful. And I cried a lot. I'm an emotional person anyway, so it's like not unusual, but I was just like, why am I crying so much reading this book? But yeah, the combination of the beautiful illustrations and the, it just felt like you were just, yeah, very authentic, very honest, and very like truthful in communicating your experience. And when you chose to terminate Azaria's pregnancy, just, yeah, the courage that it must have taken to include that.
I was so scared. I'm actually still scared, to be honest. Yeah, that was the one episode of my story where I knew I had to include it. It's such an important thing. And it's if miscarriage is taboo to talk about it, this kind of thing is even more shrouded in silence. And it's more shrouded in judgment by other people. And so I was really, really, really scared to put it in. And I had to continually stop myself from excusing myself and defending. I mean, sometimes I feel like I am defending myself for my decision within the story, but like the letter that I wrote to my friends and family about it, which I included in the book, was written well before the book was even a thought in my head. So I just had to make sure that I always kept it real, and then I wasn't like trying to soften it or make it less impactful or met less, I don't know how to describe it. Like I wanted to make sure I didn't chastise myself for it, for that decision, because I don't regret that decision. I'm still very sad about it, and I miss him a lot. And I still go every year and do a ceremony for him and the other babies that are no longer with me, where I write a letter to all of them, and then I go to Trout Lake and burn the letter, or as the case may be, this year, for example, it was monsooning, so there was no way I could light the letter on fire. Like, that wasn't happening, so I threw it into the lake. It's important for people to know that if they're going through that, it's important to know that they're not alone in that. And for people who are not going through that and who are wagging their fingers at folks that they know are going through that, that they know that it's not an easy decision, that it's soul crushing, and that it's not their place to judge what that mother is going through as they're trying to decide what to do about their baby. And I'm crying.
I mean, I can only imagine being in that situation, and I also can only imagine what it means for you to share it. And I have a lot of gratitude that you were willing to share it, because I think it is an important story to share with the world. I'm curious, you went through a lot to bring your two living babies into this world.
Yeah.
And as we were chatting about a little bit before, there's challenges, obviously, with parenting, no matter how they come to us. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts or insights. I mean, it's hard to say because you can't go back and see how it would be different. But in terms of parenting and raising these two children, how do you think your experience of just working so hard and going through so much to get to this place, how that's affected how you view parenting and all of that now?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it has informed me incredibly on many levels. Like, there's the basic parental level, but there's also the level of openness that I need to have with them because they are donor conceived. Right. So, you know, on the one hand, there's like the strength that I've had to maintain in order to bring them to life, I think has both made me more delicate and emotional, and also made me a lot stronger and a lot more patient and a lot more passionate, possibly, if that's even possible. I don't even know. Yeah, I feel like there is this just like intense bond that I have with the kids that I'm 100% sure that I would have a really strong bond with the kid had Dahlia, who was the first pregnancy, had she made it, or Fazaria had made it, or Layla, or any of them. But this is fierce. It's fierce. And I'm very aware of not being possessive of my children in terms of them being independent souls and independent beings, and they have their own thoughts and they have their own personalities. And I am very aware about letting that develop naturally and me not like foisting my wishes and all the things onto them. But also I'm very possessive of my motherhood of them. So, you know, it shows up, I now have a partner, and it shows up in how I let him interact with the children. And it shows up in kind of like these knee-jerk reactions that I have around people who are strong figures in my kids' lives. And I didn't expect it to be quite that fierce, but it really is. I don't know if I'll ever fully let go of that, but it's there. You gonna do? And then on the side of like them knowing how they came to be, what their history is, I think it's like, you know, both of the donors that I chose, yeah, they came from a sperm bank and an egg bank, but they're both, it's called open donations. So when my kids are 18, they get the contact information if they choose. And so if they choose to contact the donor, they can.
Okay.
Right. So there's that. And I have no right to contact the donors, but I will, even now I'm starting to talk about to them about their origin story and the fact that they are donor conceived, and what does that mean for a relationship, and what does that mean for, you know, the relationship with their half siblings that they have all over the world. Because on the male side, they have at least 34 half brothers and sisters.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah. And then on the egg donor side, I don't know how many people have had successful births using her eggs, but they might have another 30 or so. I don't know. So it's like building up their relationship with their siblings. They're often called diblings, donor siblings, which, you know, there's a bit of controversy about the use of that word, but there you go. So I have to parent them in that context, as well as the context of my own personal family.
Right.
And make them feel like they belong, and make them feel that they're part of a greater family, and also their donors did not reject them.
Right.
Which is a big thing. And it's interesting because now I have three embryos that I have left that are on ice, and I am stuck as to what to do with them. I'm already 46, and after all of that and the difficulty of Isaac and Abigail's pregnancy, like, I don't ever want to be pregnant again. Like, not ever. If I had done this like 10 years earlier, I would totally consider having more kids. But as it stands, I don't. I don't want to be pregnant, and I don't want to find a surrogate. And so what does that mean? What does that mean for those embryos? Do I destroy them? Do I donate them? To whom would I donate them? There's like so many options, and I feel completely frozen. As frozen as they are in my decision of what to do with them.
Your decision and your embryos are on ice.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so many layers there that sort of a family that's more traditionally formed. I don't know what the right word is to say that. Maybe there's a correct way to say that that I'm not getting. That there, those decisions, they don't have to be made. They don't have to be thought about. Those are conversations that a lot of people don't have to have with their kids and consider. And it brought up a question for me, sort of that feeling of being protective of that mothering role. You talk a lot in your book about the community support that you got through your journey and how crucial that was along the way. So has that impacted the type of support that you can accept now that you're parenting two babies on the outside?
It has. And then COVID hit.
Right.
You know, pre-COVID, I was super excited to get my kids to know as many people as possible and to accept help. I just think it's really important for kids of all ages from birth on to be able to connect with other people that are not me. And for me as a mother, in order to survive, I need to be able to accept meals from people, to accept childcare from friends and family, to accept that I can't do everything. And the community was absolutely 100% crucial in my whole journey. Like, they held my hand. They came with me to the clinic. They listened to me cry and scream and all the things. They rejoiced with me. They, you know, it was so, so important. And it helped kind of alleviate that loneliness of both being a single person doing this and a person who needed resources to help her through it and didn't find it in the books and didn't find it in the media or whatever. But I found it in my friends and my family.
Yeah. And then COVID probably has really obliterated that support.
It's terrible. So my boyfriend has been amazing and has really helped. But, you know, my parents haven't really seen the kids in person in forever.
Mm.
It's, you know, I've gone on the rare distance walk with my sisters. I have one friend who's basically in my bubble and essentially no childcare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, I'm trying to get this book out into the world and doing it when the babies nap because I have no brain at night.
Yeah, that must be a whole other thing in launching a book during COVID. That must just... I'm curious about the event that you have planned or the launch that you have planned. Is there like going to be a Zoom party or what do you have sort of planned around that?
As far as I understand, because it's not fully established yet. So it's hosted by the Vancouver Jewish Book Festival. So either me, the illustrator, and Lanny's going to be moderating, we're either going to be in our separate homes and all linked through Zoom to the wider audience, or we're going to be at the JCC just the three or four of us in an empty room with a screen and 150 people watching us. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's going to be like. I wish I had a better idea, just because that would help me kind of like build the presentation. But for sure, it's Lani's there to kind of guide the conversation and help with the Q&A. I am super excited to field people's questions. I'm very open book about everything that happened and all the emotions around it. I'm excited to share scenes from the book. Kristash, who's the illustrator, will be there as well, kind of like talking about his process and probably showing some little clips of, he did these process videos where you go from the reference picture all the way to the final image. It's kind of, what is his drawing process like? There's at least going to be that. I can say that.
Mm-hmm. There'll be something, there'll be an event to mark the occasion. It just won't look like a traditional, like wine and cheese and
right, exactly.
networking type.
Yeah.
Type book party. This being a mental health podcast, I feel obligated to ask. I'm wondering how the whole journey, how that impacted your mental health, or if you learned anything about your mental health or anything through it.
I definitely have PTSD.
Mm.
Throughout the whole journey, the longer it went, the more triggers I had for feeling angry and bitter and sad and resentful, which are all not part of my known personality pre trying to conceive. And I was always really shocked by how virulent some of my emotions were. And I really had to mitigate them and really had to be careful of how I express myself to people and how, you know, social media can really kick you in the butt when you're trying to have a baby and it's not working out. So there were people I had to unfollow. There was a lot of times where I would just curl up in a ball and be like, why is this person pregnant? They don't even want a baby. Or why is this person pregnant? They just had a baby like a year and a half ago. And I really had to be careful. And I also had to be careful with my friendships, because at some point you hit compassion fatigue. And so thank God I have the community that I have, because I was able to kind of spread it out amongst people, different people. And so I wasn't always just like asking for support from one or two people. I could really be like, okay, I talked to this person three times already about this situation. I think I need to talk to somebody else about it, because they're going to hate me for the rest of my life if I just keep, you know, being this Debbie Downer. And it's terrible, because, you know, you're like kicking yourself for being a downer, but really this is like, it's so real. So you really have to kind of fight this guilt of feeling bad all the time. It's just like an added layer of feeling bad.
It makes you feel worse than you already feel. It just like escalates it.
And then, you know, once I had the babies and they came home from the hospital, I thought, my rational brain was like, oh, everything's great now. You're going to be able to be super happy for future friends who have babies and who get pregnant. And then like, I'd see an announcement, I'd be like, oh God, all those feelings just rushed back. I'm like, why am I feeling bitter about the fact that they are pregnant or they just gave birth, or when I have two now healthy babies and I have the motherhood that I've dreamed of for so long, and it's taken over two years to kind of chill out more about it and realize that it's just like, it is the PTSD speaking. It's just a knee-jerk reaction, and that fundamentally I am happy for those people. even when I was going through it, you know, like somewhere I was happy for them. I was just, it's not about them. It's about me.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. the grief and the just like, yeah, just all the things that I had to go through and the unfairness that I felt about my situation. And, you know, I still get that, those feelings. They're a lot less, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's constant and like it continually surprises me. And the diversity of feelings that I have, it's also made me more compassionate for people. It's made me more compassionate for people's losses and people's griefs and more willing and able to listen to what people say without saying anything and without offering unsolicited advice.
Yeah, I appreciated your chapter in there when you talked about that, about the well-meaning things that people say to try and probably make themselves feel better about having said something or and to make you feel better. Yeah, these well-meaning tropes that get thrown out there that really can be quite hurtful.
Well, because and also there's just no language for around losing a baby. You know, like when you're talking about bereavement, people automatically go to, oh, your grandparent or someone who's old or who's very, very sick, and but adult,
mm-hmm.
right? These are the adults who have died. And that's one thing. And it's extraordinarily sad and devastating for some people, but it's, you know, there is a very long lineage of ways to address that with people. There's ceremony, there's words of comfort, there's actions that you can take that are not triggering necessarily for that person. But when you're dealing with the death of an infant or an unborn infant, people are at a loss. What do you say? How can you say anything? How can you really capture that? And how do you give comfort? There are no words. There aren't. There's like the best things that people did for me were drop food off, give me a hug when I asked for it or when I needed or when they offered and I said yes, like to not assume what my emotions were and not assume that. And interestingly, not assume that I was going to be crying all the time, but to make me laugh. Right? Like there were so many important moments where humor would come in and surprise me and surprise them. And it was so important because it means that that person loves you and you love them and you're able to move past the grief even for a moment. And that there's an understanding with that person that it's okay to do that.
And I imagine that those people who were able to be with you in those moments, that's probably a skill that they had cultivated and that they had done a lot of their own sort of unpacking of that and not trying to just rush to these trite places where we just brush it off with a comment or that sort of thing.
The other really interesting thing that I've noticed is, so I'll be walking with my kids or I'll be at the park and folks, random strangers will be like, oh, are those your kids? Are those your only kids? And I invariably say they're my only living kids. And it's so interesting because I can't tell if it just goes over their head. Like they've just blocked that out, that implies that I have dead children. Because either they don't respond at all and they just go on to the next topic, or they're like, oh, and then go on to the next topic.
Right.
Yeah. Like nobody says, oh, I'm sorry for your losses. Unless they've had one of their own. Then they'll be like, oh, yeah, I had a miscarriage too, or It's so interesting. It's so interesting. It's like, I don't know if it's just like this thing that humanity just cannot take that in. They can't take the loss of an infant in. It just doesn't compute.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not able to respond to it or acknowledge it or whatever. And, or maybe they just don't have the words. And so instead of trying to fumble their way through something that they figure would probably be trite anyways, because they don't know what the words are, they just ignore it, or they just not ignore it, but they just go on to the next topic because that feels safer.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I don't know. I've always been scared to confront them about that and be like, did you actually hear and understand what I just implied?
Yeah.
Really bitchy.
Well, and it's hard when it's just like a person at the park or a person that you meet, you know, those might not be situations that you want to go down that road, you know.
Absolutely. But yeah,
not the same context, but I did similar things when it was sort of in the depths of my like worst parts of my own like mental illness after having my second baby. And I would go to the park and I would like, I would say really vulnerable things, and then I would like find out who I could talk to. I did make some good friends that way, but it was just like, I'd be like just chatting, and I'd be like, I don't know if I'm going to make it through the day today, or something just like wild. And a lot of people would just be like, and then walk away. I mean, not that that's that wild of a statement, but I would say things that were quite vulnerable, and some people would be like, got to chase after my kid over here. And some people would be able to engage with me in that. And then I'd find people. So I don't know if that's been your experience. Those people that do sort of are able to respond, because that also has been their experience. If you've connected.
It's happened a lot with acquaintances.
Mm.
So, you know, some friends for sure, but a lot of folks I've had that connection with where, you know, we knew each other cursorily from previous years, you know, like, yeah, through the festival that I used to organize, or just life in general. But we never hung out. We never really talked. And then this comes out, and then there's this immediate connection and this immediate bond. And we start talking more, and we start talking about our various experiences. And then that kind of blossoms into a true friendship of talking about just life in general, and then just becoming supports for each other.
Mm.
Just being precious. It's been amazing.
Mm-hmm. That's so beautiful. Sort of like the shared pain of that, which you wouldn't wish on anyone.
Yeah.
And yet there's like all of this growth and beauty that can come out of it.
Totally. Yeah.
So the question that I usually wrap up the interview with is, if you could go back in time to a point where you were really struggling and you could be there in the room with yourself, if there's anything that you would say to that younger version of you.
It's so interesting that you say my younger version of me, because I think I felt older in those moments than I feel now.
Mm.
I actually don't know that I would, I don't know what I would say to them, because I don't know. I feel like I'm almost putting myself, like imagining myself as someone else when I'm trying to answer this question, because I wouldn't want to tell someone else, don't worry, you'll have a happy ending. It'll all be worth it. Because if I knew then what I knew now, I have no idea if I would go through the same thing again.
Mm.
It's a really hard question to answer, actually. I think I would just hold me. And just be silent and let the tears flow, and just give myself what I wanted to get from everybody else, which was just to be held and to feel like a human, to feel like a woman, to feel like that my body may not be working how I imagined it would, but that doesn't make me any less of a woman, and it doesn't make me any less of a mother. And going through loss number one, I mean, I always consider myself, the moment I became a mother was the moment that I became pregnant for the first time. And to just like remind my younger self that that is the case. And even though that child is not alive, that doesn't change the fact that I'm a mother and that I am whole and complete. And even if my biology doesn't work the way that I wish it did, that, yeah, I'm still good.
Thanks, Miriam. So if folks are interested in finding your book or following you on social media, I don't know if you have any places you want people to look for you at all that I can plug.
Sure. So I have a website, catalogbabynovel.com. I have an Instagram, which is @catalog_baby. And those are, I have a Twitter account as well, and I have a Facebook page, but my website and my Instagram are probably the busiest. That's where I'm the most present.
And the event that's coming up, if folks are interested in that.
So that's February 24th at 8:00. It'll be a Zoom meeting. You can get tickets through the Jewish Book Festival, Vancouver Jewish Book Festival. And it's on a sliding scale, so free to $18. And it's a bit of a funny event because the first half of the event is actually my sister talking about her book.
Oh.
Yeah. And then,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And then the second half is me. So we're not like, it's not a shared, it's like we're side by side, one right. after the other.
Right.
So it's not like we're talking about each other's books and talking to each other about each other's books. They're kind of like separate events, but in the same time slot, if that makes sense. So if you show up at 8:00 and you're like, where's Miriam and who, what's this other thing that's happening? Just wait 45 minutes. I'll be there.
Or rudely slide in late.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Miriam.
Oh, you're welcome. And I just also want to, I think partly for Isaac and Abigail, if that's okay. Just want to like, you know, I've talked a lot about them being donor conceived and the feelings that I had going towards, you know, their conception and their birth and how, you know, feeling like a mother with the first loss, you know, with all the losses. And I feel like I really want to acknowledge my uterus and like, and my brain and my heart and my soul for going on and really like being present for them. And that my story is not just about the losses and about all the hard feelings that I had surrounding my journey. It's also about the intense joy and ecstasy of having them in my life and feeling like a mother to them. And that they're like just everything to me.
Yeah, that real complexity of all of it, all at once, simultaneously, in this gorgeous catastrophe.
Absolutely.
Hello again. I'm back. I hope you enjoyed listening to Miriam and me chat about her book and her story. If any pieces resonated with you, I totally recommend her book. It was such a powerful read and it's so beautifully illustrated. And the topics that are contained in its pages are just so important for us to have conversations about. Other than that, I don't have a lot to add to the conversation. I will pop some resources in the show notes for people who have experienced miscarriage or pregnancy loss, or maybe you're going through it right now, there are some resources out there. For anyone out there who's struggling for whatever reason, just know that you do deserve support and you are welcome to reach out to us as well. We are available Monday to Friday, 10 to 3, by phone or text message at 604-255-7999. If that number is long distance for you, you can also reach us by phone on our toll-free line at 1-855-255-7999. And if you are in crisis, please do not wait for us to call you back. Please call your local crisis line. Here in BC, the phone number for the local crisis line is 310-6789.